Well, thank you everybody for coming. My name is Julian Dunn. I'm a product manager at Chef, and I'm actually really glad to be following Dinesh. I know Dinesh has to run. He can't stay for the talk, but you know, one of the things, I think there's actually a lot of congruence between, I don't know if this was intentional when Doug originally put this session together, but I think there's actually a lot of congruence between sort of what Dinesh is talking about needing to have a revolution in the networking space, and sort of what I'm here to talk to you about, which is I think the need to have a revolution in how we do compliance in this space, right? Because, you know, I've been a technology person for about 15 years. I started as actually a hardware developer, where I was working on ASICs and graphics ASICs for Matrox, moved into software, and then eventually I moved into operations as a system administrator, right? And now I do product for Chef, so I make, like I was saying to some folks earlier, I kind of make less with the typey-typey and more with the PowerPoints and speaking to you folks and things like this. But, you know, obviously my heart is still in a lot of the nuts and bolts of technology. And when I look at the state of compliance today, you know, this is how folks outside of the technology world look at our world, right? They're like, what are you clowns basically doing, right? That's kind of insulting to me personally, because I know that we all try to do a really good job as security, you know, in our jobs, and either security folks or sysadmins or whatever. But you know, you go to a New York Times website, and you know this is a bad state of affairs when you have a New York Times Interactive. By the way, it's a great piece of journalism. I think it's a great tool, right? But you can go to this site, this article, and basically punch in, you know, who's your healthcare provider? Okay, so if your healthcare provider was Anthem Health, for example, here's the information that's been leaked out into the world. If your credit card provider was so on and so forth, right? You go down this list and it basically tells you how much hackers have of different types of information that you have out there. This is like a pretty bad perception of IT from outside the technology world, right? And if you look at, Verizon does this really great report, by the way. Who here is actually compliant, required to be compliant with PCI? Does anybody read this report? You should read this report. It's particularly interesting. You know, Verizon's been doing this for a number of years. And what they do is they go around and survey a number of different companies and see, you know, what's the security posture, what's the compliance with PCI regulations generally. And you know, I pick up this report because we're operating in this space, we're making a compliance product, and you don't have to go beyond the title page of this report to see how bad the situation is. You know, I have to cut it off because, you know, obviously an 8.5 by 11 is not going to fit on a set of slides, but it says right on the title page, you know, 67% of organizations, they don't adequately test the security of all the supposedly in-scope systems in PCI, right? And some of the findings, if you don't have time to read this report, I'll unpack some of the findings for you. The major findings in this space are, you know, there's a large number of companies that are surveyed in this report, 10,000 every year, and then before an auditor even shows up, right? So you have some, I guess in PCI, you have some ability to speak with an auditor, you know, when they come in the door, you have some interim assessment, and you can make some changes and things like this before they give you your final report. And when these auditors come in, about 80% of these companies just fail right off the bat, right? This is 2014. I mean, how long has the PCI standard been around? It's been around for 10, 12 years, somewhere like this. What are the types of things that findings among companies that are actually breached are things like a large amount of just poor practices around patch management and even development security, right? So development security could be things like, you know, data leakage between dev and production environments, maybe dumping prod databases into development without cleaning the data, or having flags that are turned on in the production environment that are development flags by accident. Just poor general hygiene and practices around log management configuration, right? So maybe not sending all the logs to a centralized host, or not having good hygiene around cleaning up the, you know, passwords and things like that, protected information within logs. And then just firewall configuration, you know, one, and maybe this is, you know, perhaps touching a little bit on Dinesh's extend on what he's talking about is, you know, if you don't have the types of tools in that space, in the networking space, to be able to make assertions about how, you know, whether or not your firewall is actually matching your policy, then how do you know? You can type some command in your router and be like, here are all the rules. How do I know it's actually correct? Right? There's no possible way to do that right now. And so what are some of the key trends in this report, by the way? You know, what's the world look like? There's individual rule compliances going up, but the sustainability, the testing of security systems, first of all, overall testing, ongoing testing, is very, very low. So the sustainability of being able to do compliance once the auditors leave the building is actually pretty bad. I don't know if you've been in this situation. I speak to some customers sometimes. You know, a lot of customers, you know, their experience with being audited is auditor comes on site, right, and it's just a total fire drill, right? Freaking out. They're doing ad hoc operations to try and satisfy the auditor's requirements. Or if you've read a book like The Phoenix Project, you know, there's a scene in that book where the security auditors are on site and the system administrator, or sorry, the CISO takes the system administrator aside, the system administration manual manager, and says, "We found a big breach. Whatever you do, keep your folks off the floor, off the same floor that the auditors are standing on, right, while you go and fix this." You know, it's just, it's craziness, right? And then what happens is the auditors issue the report, and they leave the building, and then everybody breathes a sigh of relief, right? And everybody just goes back to business as usual until the next time, until the next quarter or the next year when you're audited, right? So this is why the ongoing sustainability is pretty poor. What are some of the drivers in the ecosystem that are causing this kind of an issue, right? Well, number one, change is constant and change is increasing in our world today. So just a general inability of folks to keep up with what is essentially a moving target. Not only a moving target in terms of, on average, about, you know, regulations change somewhere in between 18 to 20% per year, right? The things that you perhaps get from the federal government or your regulatory bodies or whatever. But the biggest change, of course, is initiated by ourselves, right? Our lines of business that want to deploy new application changes or system changes or whatever to meet the changing requirements of our customers, right? And then the other part of it is we just have no good monitoring of what the impact of these changes are with respect to compliance activities. Now, I read this. Who here knows the author Michael Lewis? Anybody have read a book by Michael Lewis? Michael Lewis is famous for a book that he wrote. Michael Lewis is a business journalist today, and he used to be a trader at Salomon Brothers in the 80s. In the 80s, he wrote this really famous book called Liar's Poker. I believe there's a movie that's coming out about it, somebody was working on a film about that. Liar's Poker is fundamentally about his experiences working at Salomon Brothers and the types of rogue behavior, the types of bad behavior that he saw in traders, and he kind of parlayed that into a career as a business journalist. And eventually he wrote this book recently that was called Flash Boys. And Flash Boys is about what the book is about doesn't actually matter that much. It's basically about the dark pools, right? So sort of off-book, off-exchange trading that a lot of big banks, investment banks engage in. But the point of that book is there's a character by the name of Brad Katsuyama. He's the protagonist in this book. And Brad is a former RBC trader who's now in charge of a dark pool that's trying to reverse kind of the bad behaviors of the HFT companies that are basically front-running a lot of, you know, yours or mine investments in our funds and things like this, right? And Brad says, and this actually wasn't in the book, I saw Brad speak at South by Southwest last year. And Brad put up this slide as part of his talk of explaining why he started the dark pool that he did. And what he described this loop as is if you want to understand the root causes of, for example, the 2007-2008 financial crisis and why scandals and increased regulation happens, he drew this diagram, which he calls the regulated industry death spiral. Okay, so what happens is, you know, in 2007-2008, some rogue actors, right, they cause a scandal by perhaps, you know, betting against themselves or other rogue market activity. And then what happens is you have regulators that come along and they react with respect to that scandal. And what regulation has the effect of doing is bleeding talent and bleeding innovation out of the system that you're trying to regulate, right? So the types of actors that you actually want managing our financial system are the ones that are like, to heck with this, right? I'm getting out of this system. And then what's left behind in the financial industry, this is what he argues, is the Wolf of Wall Street kind of types of folks, right? And so what those folks then try to do is they find a loophole and they try to exploit it, right? And when they exploit that loophole, that causes another scandal, which then causes this death spiral, right? So how do we get to this bad situation of a state of affairs with respect to compliance? You know, like I said, PCI 1.0 was ratified in 2004, right? Over 10 years ago. And that was before the days of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, right? Mobile apps, and so on and so forth. And what I showed at the beginning is, right, the state of affairs is getting worse, and it's not getting better with all this stuff, right? So expect this downward trend to continue if we just continue down whatever road we're attempting to continue down while we're asserting compliance, right? So what I argue is that there's a fundamental problem at the root of doing compliance today, which is that we're not speaking with the same terminology and using the same tools and artifacts to communicate between all the different actors that are involved in compliance, okay? So you have compliance officers to the left, which are traditionally trying to document whatever regulations are coming down from the regulated bodies or, you know, perhaps their CIO or CEO, usually in some kind of like Excel spreadsheet, right? If you've worked long enough, you've worked in an enterprise, right, you perhaps have gotten this spreadsheet handed to you, be like, this is our security policy, right? This is what you're supposed to do. Here's how you can remain compliant with SOX or PCI or what have you. Okay, then you have a bunch of InfoSec folks who are often doing penetration testing or using proprietary tools and things like this. So if you're lucky, they're perhaps using shell scripts, right? They're asking you for access to your systems as a sysadmin. Can I just run the shell script on there? Well, what's in there? I have no idea. Right, they're just running a thing to gather some information, right, if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, they're using some other tool. If you're lucky, maybe they're using Nessus or something like this, but if you're not lucky, they're using some other toolkit that you have no idea, and they're scanning your system and they're doing things with, right, and so, you know, again, you're not using the same kind of tools as your compliance folks. Then you have operations folks, right, like you or I, who are managing systems using, as I said, I work for Chef, right? So that's why there's a little Chef logo up there, but you could be using Puppet or Ansible or whatever, but you're rewriting some code and you're managing your systems using a completely different set of tools, right? There's no opportunity to have this common communication. Everybody's just like talking a completely different language. It's like the Tower of Babel, right? And then what happens is when you do scanning, and so my talk is about like why I think scanning really doesn't work, is when you do a bunch of network scanning or penetration testing scanning, you get handed, as a sysadmin, you get handed this giant binder of results. I mean, who the heck even knows that those are valid? I mean, who's been in that situation, right? Been scanned, often by an external company, right? And you get this report, and it's like, you know, 600 pages long. You look at this thing, and it's like, oh, well, your version of Apache is vulnerable. I'm like, no, it's not, because I patch it quarterly, right? And they're like, oh, but the banner that it responds to says it's Apache 2.2, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, have you people never heard of like Red Hat backporting fixes, right, from the CVEs and things like this, right? It's useless data, and it's often repeated, right? They'll scan your network, 3,000 hosts or whatever, or even more, right, thousands of hosts, and then you get, like, you open up the 600-page document, and the first 80 pages are like, here are all the individual hosts that have, you know, some Apache banner that is, like, insecure, quote-unquote. And you look at this is garbage, right? So what happens is the sysadmin takes this thing and just tosses it in the garbage. I mean, that's what I did, right? Because I'm like, well, I know I have a reasonably good security posture, I think, right? And I really would love for somebody to tell me what parts are actually missing. But throwing me a binder that's like 800 pages long, which 95% of it is useless, right? I'm not gonna pay attention to that. I'm not gonna spend the time to go through that, right? And so that's why I think like the whole approach of scanning is wrong, right? And then the other part of it is you have this like security review process, right? How many folks have this kind of a, before you deploy anything to production, like a new application or things like this, you have to go through some kind of security review, right? So a handful of folks. So you're humming along, right? Your application developers are humming along. They're trying to deploy new changes, right? New business features, like I said, for the lines of business. So you get through dev, you get through QA, you get to staging or whatever, pre-prod environment. Then you have to do this security review. So you go and talk to the security officer, and this poor person, right? I have a lot of sympathy for them. They have no idea what you've even been working on up until this point, right? And so they're handed this artifact. Here's a WAR file, or here's an environment with like WebSphere, whatever, with an application deployed in it. Can you sign off on this thing that it's secure? Because we need to go to production, like right now, right? The business needs to get features out. And you know, I analogize this to kind of a dam, right? Because if you're throwing stuff at them, then many other groups, many other application teams in the company are also throwing things at them, right? And so that's where all these changes are backed up. And the security person has no context about what is even being worked on, what this application even does in most situations, right? So they can only operate at a very, very low velocity. And then what happens is escalations happen. You know, like the line of business goes to the CIO and says, you folks are too slow. You're backing up my changes, right? So what we're gonna do is we'll just skip the security review, right? Well, to heck with it, right? And it's taking too long. So we'll just deploy that thing directly into production in most cases, right? And then what we'll do to, as a countermeasure, is we'll scan it, right? This is where the scanning comes from. Somehow we'll do the scanning, we'll catch these things later, right? I just think, you know, we just need to, this is all garbage to me. I think we just need to, like, I wish I could just hire Mythbusters, we could just blow this thing up, right? Because it's the wrong approach. We need to inject, as Brad says, we need to inject innovation into the system in order to fix this, right? But first we need to understand what we actually mean when we talk about security and compliance. Those are not the same thing, okay? You could technically, in many regimes, right, you could technically be compliant by the letter of the law or the regulation or whatever by taking measures that actually have nothing to do with security, right? PCI actually gives you these escape hatches, but, you know, like you can have compensating controls and things like this, right, within PCI for you to become, you know, stay compliant without actually having secure systems. And what I argue is that compliance isn't just a checkbox. Right, we're treating it like it's just a checkbox. We're treating it like we just need to be compliant and check the compliance box to get these pesky auditors out of the room in order for us to go back to our regular jobs, right? And I think that really comes down to you can't be compliant until you're first secure. So how can we figure out how to be secure and stay secure on an ongoing basis instead of just scanning for security periodically and hoping that that's enough? Well, one of the core principles, I think, is that if you look at security as an aspect of quality, you have to build it right into the system. And so this is, who's read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance here? Pretty popular book amongst technology folks, right? So I'll sum it up for you if you haven't read it. Robert Persig, this is him with his son, Chris, who's featured in the book, basically on his journey of traveling across America, he relives his experience trying to define what quality is and what are the aspects of quality. And one of the important things that he points out in the book is that quality is not a thing that you can add on to a system that doesn't have it. You can't just bolt it on to the back, right? It has to be part of the motorcycle. If you're going to build a quality motorcycle, you can't simply slap a whole bunch of parts together and be like, oh, well, now I'm going to like add quality. Now I'm going to make this motorcycle correct, right? It doesn't work. So this is sort of how I also like think about how American auto manufacturing used to be compared to Japanese auto manufacturing, right? In Japanese auto manufacturing, quality is built into every step. I mean, that's where all this like lean manufacturing stuff comes from with the Andon cord and things like this, where the workers can pull the Andon cord and stop the assembly line if they detect a quality problem. Whereas the way American manufacturing used to work, car manufacturing used to work, is you'd have a bunch of folks, you know, slapping parts together on this car, and then at the end of the assembly line, if you watched, there was always a person that was armed with an angle grinder, you know, a mallet, that was, you know, would sand down the rough edges of the car, like make the door fit because it didn't fit originally when the person put it on, you know, three steps up the assembly line. I mean, it's a stupid way of doing business, right? You have to build this into the actual system if you want it to be high quality. So really what you want to do is, if you accept my premise that quality has to be built into the system, you want to design and develop tools that reinforce this behavior, right? You want to have tools that reinforce the culture that you want to build quality in. And then basically, it's a virtuous feedback loop, right? The tools will then ultimately reinforce the behavior and the culture that you want, and everybody will be happy. So if you look at the types of tools that I think that we need that aren't scanning tools in the world, the first thing you have to do is like look at all what's the intent and what are folks actually trying to accomplish in all these different regulatory frameworks, right? Be it HIPAA, be it SOX or PCI or any of the European ones, any of the ones in APAC and things like this, and pull out, you know, what's the intent of the legislation? What are the commonalities and types of behaviors that folks are trying to enforce in these regimes? And if you look at the rule types, you can actually break them down into four categories. And the four categories are things like the scope, right? So make sure that if you have some third-party access that they're not accessing, they're not all logging in with a shared account, right? Then perhaps logging in using their own personal accounts. Or the logging system will only have access to the global logs, for example. Then you have a number of controls and things like this that are specified, like you have to do a thing before another thing. So yeah, like it's a good idea to turn on your firewall before you turn on your web server, right? Or it's a good idea to register your computer to the domain before you let anybody on it, right? Then you also have state rules, which are about inspecting the system at rest, right? So you can have things like you cannot have the customer data and the form data be logically co-resident on the same server, right? Or you can't have, let's say, a trading application and some other thing on the same machine, deployed on the same computer. Or it could be as simple as this package must be installed, like NTP. You have to have your clock synchronized, right? It could also be things like we are making a choice to use SE Linux and Centrify or something. Or it could be something like we are choosing to use Digital Guardian and not sudo. Right, these kinds of assertions. And then the fourth area in these regulatory regimes that's of interest is supervision, right? Which is basically just like the cross-cutting, being able to have an audit trail of what's going on the systems, right? So what I want to do is talk a little bit about the software that we've developed at Chef, which is completely open source, to attempt to capture all these types of controls that you might want, right? InSpec, which is kind of a cool name because it's like you can think of it as inspector, or an infrastructure specification. It is a flexible and cross-platform domain-specific language that is targeted primarily at compliance. And you can use this language to run tests either locally, logged onto the machine, or it's got a transport layer, so you could run it from your laptop and it will use SSH or will use WinRM to log into a machine and run a bunch of tests there and then tell you what the results were. So the language is specifically designed, contrary to, forget the term that Dinesh was using in the previous talk, but contrary to these very fixed schema type of systems that we've perhaps seen in this space, it's completely open and it's freeform, right? It's structured, but it's freeform. It allows you to define the controls and policies that are of interest to you. And the language is specifically designed to be a common language that is usable and readable by operations, info security, and compliance folks. And this is open source, it's available today, so you can have a look. And I'll show you just a little bit of the language, right? So you can see that every rule that you're writing is defined as a control, and a control has a title, and you can attach metadata to this control that's of interest to folks that are monitoring to see like how severe is the thing that I'm defining here, right? And also like what regime it's compliant to or what rule or whatever. And then you write a test, okay? So for example, in this, which I pulled from CIS, section 3.1, is you need to have certain permissions on your grub bootloader configuration, right? So you could write some assertions about that bootloader configuration needs to be owned by root and the group needs to be root as well. And you can write some additional things in here as well, right, for like what mode the file should be. And it's got a lot of built-in primitives and helpers to be able to do things like a little bit even more complex than this. You could have registry keys or things like this. But you know, the objective is you don't need to be a programmer, you don't need to be a sysadmin to be able to write these kinds of tests, right? So in the past, we've seen certain tools where you need to know like a bunch of shell and a bunch of grep and awk and all this kind of stuff in order to do this stuff, right? So the language provides basic primitives for folks to be able to just write high-level assertions about this. So you can imagine writing assertions that are related to the regimes of interest, right? So you could write a rule, you could write a control, pardon me, about in PCI, right, it says that you have to have non-console administrative access encrypted. So you could check for, you know, making sure that telnet is not actually turned on and listening, right? Port 23, very, very easy to understand. And then this on the right-hand side, this is just some logic from our Chef Analytics product, which basically you can think of the control side as the stimulus gathering, right, the data gathering, and then you can have a product that, like Chef Analytics, which basically could process that information and send you a page or an email or whatever it is, right? Socks, another example, right? Be able to establish some controls to track the data access, right? So you could interpret this, or one of the things you might interpret this as being is, you know, making sure that the password authentication is turned on your SSHD, right? And then you could take this kind of information and roll it up, right? If you just run InSpec on the command line, it would give you a text report, but you could then take this data, you could roll up into a system like Chef Compliance where it would give you nice graphs about all your systems, right, and the severity of all the things as you identified them in metadata. You could override the severity per machine and so on and so forth. But anyway, this is not a vendor pitch. Obviously, I'm just showing you, right, that this is how you might be able to use the language that we've established. And the other point that I was trying to make is that you can use a tool like InSpec as part of that entire pipeline that I was showing before, right? So you make sure that you're not just checking this kind of security at the end when it's time for the security review. So you can make sure that even when your development team is working on their application, that they could be running the same test that you are going to go and assert when you're checking your production environment, right? And so they know right away, even before hitting operations, that perhaps some change that they've made to the running system in a VM or whatever is something that has broken compliance. So they can address it very, very early, and they can run those tests as part of their acceptance test suite. It's a kind of a build pipeline, you know, like Chef Delivery or Jenkins or what have you. So back to Brad for a second, right? So Brad says that the only way that you can break this regulated industry death spiral is if you forcibly inject some innovation into the system. And if you inject innovation into the system, what it will do is it will attract the actors that you want to be working in this universe, right? So what we're trying to do here is injecting innovation here in the hopes that folks can be able to not always... So that folks don't always feel like they're always responsive, they're always reacting only to regulatory pressures, right? That these regulatory pressures, or these regulations are actually, they have a hand in creating them. As I said before, we have this compliance Tower of Babel where everybody's using a different artifact, and that's why there's so much confusion, and nobody really knows how to communicate. And we're hoping that using a tool like InSpec, like a piece of software like this, where you can define a document that everybody can read from, your compliance, your InfoSec folks, and your operations folks, that everybody is singing from the same song sheet. And traditionally, right, the way the world has worked is that, you know, where do the regulatory requirements come from? They come from government bodies, they come from, you know, your particular industry regulatory body or what have you. And they create these regulations, and those regulations are fed down to executives in your company. And the executives in your company then feed that information to the different business units or to operations or whatever. It's like a one-way flow. There's no ability to have a conversation about, do these regulations actually work? Do they make any sense? Or can they actually be executed, right? And our hope is that by creating technological innovation as part of this, we can create a feedback loop where it's like, all right, executives, this is what you want us to do, and what we've been able to do and prove to you is here are all the regulations that we could apply, but here's some feedback for you. Here are the things that don't really work well in some of the policies that you're trying to establish, right? And that will help the executives be able to have a conversation then upstream with regulators and help shape the future regulations and future revisions of different regulations, right? So I just sort of want to leave it there. Which is, I'm hoping that in the future, right, audits and compliance generally won't be as painful of an activity as it is today, and that we'll actually be able to have secure systems, we'll be able to reduce our attack surfaces, and we'll basically have, make for a better and more secure world. So thank you very much. And I'm happy to entertain some questions.
So the examples that you used, Puppet and Chef already know how to fix those problems. You're trying to identify that they're broken. Maybe I'm missing the boat here, but I'm wondering what value this provides above and beyond just having Puppet manifests or Chef recipes that just make it right to begin with, rather than trying to detect something that's incorrect.
Right, so there's sort of two sides to that. So one is that Puppet, Chef, Ansible, they're very good at being able to fix and manage declared state, the things you know that you want to manage, but it doesn't tell you about all the things that you don't. I mean, you could, for example, write a Puppet manifest or a Chef recipe to be like, I'm going to specify all 700 packages, you know, within a rel distribution that should or shouldn't be installed. But it's impractical. Most people don't do that, right? If they're setting up a web server, they'll just be like, package HTTPD or whatever, right? But it doesn't tell you whether or not sendmail is installed, right? Unless you explicitly write that. So that's sort of one angle of this. The other angle of this is that a lot of the tests that you can write within this kind of a language are about live system state, which are not really things that you can you can check for or repair within declarative configuration management. So for example, is this port open, right? Or is this process running? Or does this registry key exist? Like that kind of stuff. Or even like, do these temporary files live in this directory or that sort of stuff, right? Those are just simply spaces that, you know, convergent CM just doesn't play in.
Hi, Julian.
Yeah.
A question, how does this inspect tool and like all the tests that you can write relate to OpenSCAP? I don't really know what OpenSCAP is about. I saw there was another talk about it.
There was. I was hoping somebody would ask this question. So OpenSCAP, so I went to the OpenSCAP talk yesterday. I know a little bit about OpenSCAP. And one of the challenges, I mean, I think Martin put it right in his slides, actually, which is that OpenSCAP is one of those standards that's very good if you have already written a set of benchmarks, right? And you're just applying them and running them against the system. And I think somewhere about slide 17 in his presentation yesterday, if you want to extend OpenSCAP to write your own policy, it is extremely, extremely difficult. And having a language that's a little bit easier for folks to use, as you can see, it's pretty easy if you want to just customize. That's sort of the differentiator.
Could you back up to the slide about the checking for telnet port disabled real quick? Yep, there we go. Okay.
Yep.
There's something really bothersome about this, right? So congratulations, there's nothing listening on port 23. No one would ever set up telnet on a port other than 23, right? Except they do all the time. Not even out of maliciousness, just out of expediency. Oh, it's taking too long to get the firewall rule. Oh, it's taking forever to get SSH key rotated. So I'm just going to fall back to something that actually works to get the system done right.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of no way around that sort of weirdness without scanning.
Not really. Well, I mean, like, it depends. It depends whether or not you're in an arms race with your system administrators, I suppose, right? Because you could write a rule that's like, is there a process named telnetd running, right? Okay, now right, that's what I mean about the arms race. Okay, so is somebody changing the proc? Did somebody set proc title on the telnetd process to call it something else, right? I mean, how far are we going? Are we trying to battle ourselves, or are we trying to battle malicious intruders? I suppose.
Okay.
So is the idea that this inspect tool is launched after like the configuration management agent passes by, or?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
No.
So it can run out of band.
Yeah, this actually has very little to do with Chef. I mean, it has to do with Chef only in the sense that you could use Chef to remediate the system. Actually, this has nothing to do with, like, you could use this tool even without configuration management. You could use this to analyze whether, like, just the general posture of your infrastructure.
So does it then push those rules to the machine, or are the rules kept on like on a central machine?
They are executed, like you can either execute on that machine itself or you can remote to that machine.
Okay, thanks.
All right, well, thanks very much for coming.